This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Our topic today will be the environment and the environmental risks to cancer, and we'll introduce our guests shortly. But before I do that, I think it's an important thing to remind each of our listeners that once again this year, they've been doing this for a number of years, the Alaska Urological Associates and Alaska Regional Hospital are partnering to provide a free prostate screening evaluation. The test dates are the days that this is going to be done are Saturday, September 13th from 10 to 4, and then Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday of the following week between 4 and 8. The testing, including an exam and a prostate-specific antigen test, will be done at the Alaska Urologic Associates office. You can get more information by calling 276-1474. These evaluations will be done on the Alaska Regional Campus. The Prostate Cancer Educational Council recommends that all men should have a baseline prostate-specific antigen test at age 40 and then annual screening starting at age 45. However, if you're age 40 or older and have a family history of prostate cancer, then you should be starting at about age 40 or thereafter. So the number for more information about the appointments, 276-1474. They start this coming Saturday, and then they'll be Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday of next week. My guest today is Dr. Deborah Davis. Dr. Davis is the head of the Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute. This is a multidisciplinary center that includes experts in medicine and research, engineering, public policy, who are developing studies to identify the causes of cancer and then work to propose policies that reduce these risks. Her most recent book is The Secret History of the War on Cancer, and a previous book was a National Book Award finalist. It was entitled When Smoke Ran Like Water. Dr. Davis was our guest previously in June of this year, and about the time we were scheduling that interview, we realized she was going to be up here this month, and we'll talk about some of the other ways you may get to hear Dr. Davis during the course of this interview. But she's graciously agreed to interview again, and she's joining us by telephone from Majestic Lodge. Where is Majestic Lodge, Dr.
Majestic
Davis?
Valley Lodge is at mile about 114 on the Glen Highway and very close to the Matanuska Glacier in some of the most beautiful country here, but it seems that much of Alaska is beautiful, and I'm really grateful to have a chance to visit it and to meet with people working on the issue of reducing the burden of toxic contamination for this great state of Alaska.
So I take it that's one of the reasons you're here, is to look at what's going on here and to help those who are interested and do something about their risks.
Absolutely. I'm working with some of the citizen groups, some of the research communities, such as the Alaska Community Action on Toxics, as well as meeting with medical doctors and researchers at the University of Anchorage and Fairbanks, who are developing research projects on these issues as well.
I want to talk about your book for sure, but I can't help but, I guess, move quickly to the logical next question is, since you've visited here, what are the environmental concerns that come to your mind that us in Alaska need to be aware of?
Well, let me just say that I can hardly appear to be an expert on such a complex and interesting state. I did get to go down to Valdez and see the pipeline and the earthquake precautions that have been taken, and I have clearly a sense from the information that has been obtained through the state and the federal government that there are areas where there are residues of past mistakes, including military contamination from the time when people just assumed that Alaska was so big it didn't matter what you threw into it, and there's a legacy from that attitude that is still percolating through the ecosystem. And it's obvious that one needs to be mindful of the fact that pollutants do not need passports. And even if you can restrict or ban something today, certain persistent organic pollutants can last a very, very long time and move up the food chain. And you're seeing results of that in some of the things that have been found in the river and the fish and have affected the health and habitat of the polar bear and others. So I'm interested, and I'm still, if I may say, in the learning phase, but it's obvious that we have to understand that predators are teaching us something, because at the top of the Arctic food chain is the polar bear. At the top of the human food chain is the nursing infant. And we have seen evidence that certain native groups have very high levels of contaminants in their breast milk, and that's of great concern. We also know that fish oil can be a very beneficial thing for people to eat, and there may be less of a problem where diets are high in fish oil and some of the good things that you do get in Alaska more readily. So it's at this point, I'm just continuing a process of learning about what's going on here, and I'll be going up to Nome tomorrow and speaking in Anchorage on Thursday evening, as well as meeting with physicians and speaking with medical groups on Friday at noon.
Now, why don't we go ahead and mention that? You're going to be talking at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium Thursday, September 11th at 7 p.m., mm-hmm. and then at the Providence Cancer Center in their media center on Friday, the next day, September 12th, from 12 to 1 p.m. Right. I'm sure the public is invited to this Wendy Williamson discussion. Is the cancer center for the public also, or is that more a physician-professional talk?
I'm sure both talks, as far as I know, will be open to the public. The talk at the Cancer Center, of course, will focus more on the research results of the work that we're doing at our Center for Environmental Oncology and some of the underlying science about why we understand that most cases of cancer occur in people who are born with healthy genes and something happens to give them the disease. And we know that because of research that's been done with twins that I'm going to be talking about, where we've taken identical twin, and we know that identical twins start from the same egg that splits, as you know, at conception. And at about age 3, the chromosomes of those identical twins look just about the same. But remarkable studies have been reported on in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences by Maria Fraga and colleagues in Scandinavia, and they have found that by age 50, if you look at those chromosomes of identical twins, some of them do not even look related to one another. And what that's telling us is the tremendous role that the environment plays, even with identical twins. They start out as close to a clone as we have in human nature, but by age 50, they're very different. And so we can say, as I will in my talks, that genes give us the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger.
Now, there's certainly been a huge interest in almost not just cancer, but in chronic diseases in general, of this interaction between genes and the environment. And it, I think it's really perhaps, I would think, helped your efforts to help to get people to be a little bit more thinking long term about what we're doing to the environment. You mentioned this military leaving things around, the Love Canal. There's a lot of, it seems like it's a long history of thinking that we don't have to worry about the future. And that seems like one of the big messages that I hear from you and in reading your books.
That is exactly right. We have to understand that even small levels of pollutants add up over time, and we need to be particularly vigilant about protecting the young children, pregnant women, and men who want to become fathers, because we know that susceptibility to a toxic pollutant depends on how fast cells are growing. So the most rapidly growing cells we have are those in the male making sperm, and of course in the embryo and fetus during conception. And we need to protect children after they're born as well, because the brain doubles in the first 2 years of life. So we want to make sure that we are giving our children the best start possible, not only in terms of the appropriate stimulation for their minds and hearts and souls, but also protecting them from heavy metals and other things that can be insidious in their impact on the developing brain. The brain of a child doesn't fully mature, actually, won't surprise parents of teenagers, until the late teenage years. And we really need to protect the brains of children.
Let me remind our listeners, if they'd like to give us a call, that they're welcome to do so. You're listening to Line 1. My guest today is Dr. Deborah Davis. She's an epidemiologist in the environmental effects of cancer. So please feel free to give us a call. You can reach us at 550-8433 if you have any questions or comments about what you hear today. Again, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can also email me at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. And be sure and remember that if you want to listen to the program later, you can just go to kska.org and subscribe or listen or recommend people who you think should listen to the program. Go at any time in the future, and this program will be available for listening to. I started the last time we interviewed with what I thought was a kind of a good way to get into your book, The War on Cancer. And it, you mentioned that we've been into this over 40 years since Richard Nixon basically launched this in 1971. And what are the important lessons that we've learned about the war on cancer?
Well, I think one of the first things that there's a general acceptance with now is that this war started off as a war to find and treat the disease, and ignored the things in 1971 that were already known to cause cancer. In 1964, the Surgeon General of the United States had issued a report saying that tobacco caused lung cancer and other diseases. In 1964, 7 years later, President Nixon launches a war on cancer that is silent about tobacco, that ignores benzene and asbestos, which were known to cause cancer at the time the war was launched. So a number of scientists, like Joshua Lederberg, a Nobel laureate, advised that this was not the right strategy to simply focus on finding and treating the disease, that you needed to also pay attention to tackling the things that we already knew caused cancer. Unfortunately, that wasn't done. And in my book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, I explain that some of the reasons this wasn't done are just understandable. The focus, if you have cancer, and I, as I did, have both of my parents with deal with the disease, all you want is for them to be treated and cured. But the problem that we have to deal with here is that that isn't going to work if we simply get better at finding and treating the disease and do not deal with the causes of cancer. We'll become simply more efficient at processing sick people. So what I make the point here is that we've got to pay more attention to the things that we know cause cancer and also to the things that we have good reason to think probably cause it.
So the effort has been, as you said, to treat it and find the diagnose or find what's going on, who's got these diseases. Why? What are the reasons that you discovered or you think you understand why we didn't go after the things? And the logical answer is politics and money. Is that correct, or is there more to
well,
it?
Well, it's more. It's, I think it's a little bit more complicated. It's also the willing suspension of disbelief. I mean, we, Americans have this idea that if you're sick, it's your fault, and we're going to figure out something to do for you as an individual. And we've been reluctant to accept the fact that some of our illness really isn't a result of what we do as individuals, but what we do as a society together. Mm-hmm. And a decision, for example, to allow asbestos to be sprayed into homes, a decision to not inform people that they may have asbestos in their attics, really is a public health decision. We now understand that benzene emissions from the refining of natural gas as well as petroleum can be much greater than we've estimated in the past. And we know that benzene causes cancer. We've known that, unfortunately, for almost 100 years. And yet we have not done a good enough job of controlling some of the sources of it that can be controlled in some cases with cooling towers and other things in the process. So we've got to be smarter about letting technology work for our health and not against it.
Okay. We have a caller. I'd like to go ahead and take Pam's call right now. Pam, you're on line one. What would you like to ask?
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. I'm curious, Dr. Davis, to know about breast cancer. There has been a primary focus really on detection using mammography, and I wondered if you could speak about why there is such reluctance to address prevention and possible linkages with environmental carcinogens. And, you know, I'm aware of some of the work done by Silent Spring Institute, and I wondered if you could speak to that.
Well, thank you. Yes, there are a number of environmental causes of breast cancer that have been identified in research recently released by the Silent Spring Institute, as well as the Breast Cancer Fund, and links to that can be found on the website for our center, which is preventingcancernow.org. These studies have reviewed more than 2,000 different reports that have looked at occupational factors that increase the chance that breast cancer will develop. What we know about breast cancer is this. The more hormones a woman is exposed to in her lifetime naturally, the greater her chance of developing breast cancer. We've known that, by the way, for several hundred years when the observation was made by Ramazzini in the 17th century that nuns had a high rate of breast cancer. And he concluded correctly it was because nuns had many more menstrual cycles, many more periods, exposing them to many more hormones. Well, now in the modern era, I've worked with colleagues who've developed a theory that there are xenoestrogens, xeno for the Greek word foreign, and these things can stimulate the amount of estrogen in the body. So we know that the earlier in life a girl gets her period and the later in life she enters menopause, the greater the risk of breast cancer. But now we understand that environmental chemicals can influence that. They can influence when girls reach maturity. They can prolong the amount of hormones in a woman's body. The more fat a woman has in her body after menopause, the more estrogen she will have circulating in her body. The more alcohol a woman drinks, the greater her risk of breast cancer. If she uses hormone replacement therapy, the greater her risk of breast cancer. So we know that there are certain things, like hormone replacement therapy, that clearly increases the risk of breast cancer, and recent research has indicated that there are other agents that also can increase the amount of circulating estrogen in the body and therefore increase the risk of breast cancer. And among the things that have been identified by the Silent Spring Institute, the Breast Cancer Fund, and others are certain plastics, certain solvents, degreasing agents, and some pesticides. And all of these have been shown in experimental studies to accelerate the growth of breast cancer cells. And we also have some information from humans that women who are regularly exposed to these things also have an increased risk of breast cancer.
Pam, you still with us? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's very interesting. Thank you. And I have a second question, if there's time.
Sure.
Dr. Davis, you spoke in your introduction about the many military sites around Alaska, and we have over 700 formally used defense sites, and the Arctic in the north has become a hemispheric sink for pollutants from all over the world. And there's been a lot of denial about any linkages between perceived higher rates of cancer in Alaska Native communities particularly and exposure to contaminants from living in proximity to these hazardous waste sites. And epidemiologically, I know it's difficult to study small populations. How would you best address this issue?
Well, you've raised a very important and difficult question for public health research. The best and simplest research to conduct in humans are clinical trials where you take people and give them a drug, take another group, don't give them the drug, and see whether you have made a change in a given disease, for example, diabetes or heart disease. Unfortunately, the real world is messy, and we don't get an opportunity to study it very easily. And as you indicated, you've got very small populations living in proximity to some of these 700 sites. And because the numbers of people are small, it's extremely difficult to get what are called significant results. But something can be important for public health without being statistically significant. And what we need to do in those circumstances is make better use of experimental information that comes from studies that we conduct in laboratories, looking at cell cultures, looking at whole animals. And that's where I think we are on the cusp of a revolution in understanding how we can approach prevention of cancer in a more intelligent manner. We've got to stop debating whether we have proof of human harm in the form of significant numbers of sick or dead people in a small area, and we've got to start using experimental information developed from laboratories like the work we're developing at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute and other institutions. And if we do that, we'll stop treating people inadvertently like lab rats in an experiment without any controls.
Okay. Pam, thanks for your call.
Yes, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Davis, does that thought process, it makes me think of something that I wanted to ask, and I don't think we got into the last program, and that's something called the precautionary policy or precautionary principle. Are you familiar with that, and does that ring with what you're saying here?
Certainly. I'm going to be talking about that with the President's Cancer Panel in a week in New Jersey. Because it's the fundamental challenge that we have today. The precautionary principle, which has been enunciated by a number of groups and has been adopted in large part by the European Union, is being used by a number of states and cities, says something very simple. It's better to be safe than sorry. Here in Alaska, you don't send your children to school without an umbrella or a heavy coat if you know they're going to hit bad weather. You give them the protection they need in advance of their being at risk. You don't wait for them to be starving before you give them food for lunch. It's better to be safe than sorry. It's something every parent knows when they send their kids off to school. We've got to take that approach as well to things in the environment. And that means that rather than waiting for proof that something is damaging to our health, we have to ask in the first place for demonstration of its safety. And that's actually a very difficult and different approach that we need to take. Most people do not appreciate that many widely used cleaning products inside their home can contain and not be labeled for containing chemicals that cause cancer in animals. And we need to stop that practice by giving people information and requiring labeling of materials so that people have a right to know. That's a fundamental concept of the precautionary principle. You have a right to know. You want to use a cleaning product in your home that contains a carcinogen? You have the right to do that. But right now, the companies have the right to put such a product into your cleaning agent and not even tell you that it is a carcinogen.
Another caller has called and left a question but did not want to go on the air, and it addresses the issue of cell phones, and particularly what do we know about the effects on children and cell phones, and especially as it relates to brain cancer. Now, I know we've discussed this in the previous program, but I think it's an interesting enough issue that we discuss it again.
There will be a congressional hearing on this subject on September 25th in Washington, D.C., convened by the Domestic Policy Subcommittee of the Committee on Government Operations and Oversight. And at that hearing, Dr. Ronald Herbermann, who is the director of the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute, will be testifying. What he will testify about can be found on the website for our center, preventingcancernow.org. The studies from the cell phone industry indicate that the cell signal is absorbed into the brain much more deeply into the brain of children than that of adults. In fact, French Telecom recently released a report showing that the cell phone signal is absorbed almost entirely through the brain of a five-year-old. Now, we need to understand that absorption into the brain does not equate with brain cancer, but as I indicated earlier, the brains of children need to be protected, and nobody can tell us that that is a safe thing to do to our children right now. That is why the government in England and Germany and France have issued advisories recommending that children not use cell phones except for emergencies or using them with text messaging so that they are not holding the phone directly to their head. If you read the direction for the new iPhone, it says hold the phone 5/8 inch from your head. I don't know about you, but I can't hear if I hold my phone too far from my head. So what I recommend, what Dr. Herbermann has advised, based on a review of recommendations from other nations and other experts, is that you use your phone with an earpiece, that you use your phone with a speakerphone. We understand cell phones save lives. And we know the most serious public health problem is car accidents from people using cell phones or text messaging while they're on the phone. But the long-term question of brain cancer is deeply troubling because brain cancer, as you know, can take 10 years or more to develop. 10 years ago, few people used cell phones regularly. Today, it's about 9 out of every 10 people. And a lot of people have the phone on all the time, on their bodies, and use it right next to their head on a regular basis. We think it's better to be safe than sorry, and therefore we recommend prudent precautions be taken, and that information can be found on our website, and there's an excellent report reviewing the scientific literature throughout the world called the Bioinitiatives Report that can be found linked from our website that provides a good overview of thousands of studies that have been done on radio frequency radiation.
Let me just take a second also to remind our listeners, if you want some links, including links to Dr. Davis's website and the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute Center for Environmental Oncology website, which she's referred to, you can go to our website, kska.org/line1, and you can get those direct links, including a link to one of the Center for Environmental Oncology's statements about 12 things we can all do to help decrease our cancer risk, which we may get into shortly. But
I also wanted to mention that I have a new website, devradavis.com, that provides information about some of these issues and also gives people an opportunity to contribute to the work that we're trying to do to make prevention the cure for cancer. It's really important to recognize that right now the federal budget has resulted in declines in funding for environmental research across the board. And small contributions from people like your listeners make a big difference to our ability to continue to carry out our effort to see that we reduce the burden of cancer from the environment.
And Dr. Davis's website is also a link on our website. We've added that as well. So you're listening to Line One. My guest is Dr. Devra Davis. Our topic is in the epidemiology of the environment, environmental impacts on cancer. Dr. Davis is an expert in the area. If you've got questions, here's how you can ask them or get any issues cleared up in your mind. 550-8433, 550-8433. Also, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Or email me at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. Reminder also that Dr. Davis will be speaking Thursday, September 11th at 7 p.m. at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium, and then Friday, September 12th from 12 to 1 at the Media Center at the Providence Cancer Center. As a cancer epidemiologist, what kind of things bother you the most right now in the United States?
Well, I'm very concerned about the ignorance that many people have about plastic and the fact that we should never be microwaving in plastic and that we need to work with the plastic industry to see that we have safer forms of plastic developed so that they don't migrate from plastic into food and into our bodies. The Centers for Disease Control released a study 2 years ago that found the highest residues of plastics in our body occurred in young people, children again. And we don't know why that is the case, but we think it's not a good idea. I'm also, of course, concerned, and on our website we have information in our newsletters about this, about the inappropriate use of diagnostic radiation, again, particularly in children. There's been a tenfold increase in CAT scans in the past decade, again, increasing tremendously in children. And they're not tenfold healthier in any way. CAT scans save lives when used appropriately. If you have a child that's unconscious and comes into the emergency room, you may need a CAT scan of their head. But CAT scans are being overused, and there's such a serious problem here that the American College of Radiology is calling for a national campaign to warn doctors about the misuse of CAT scans. Information on that can also be found on the website devradavis.com and preventingcancernow.org.
Okay. I guess I ought to mention also what, you know, we had discussed that last time you were a guest, and subsequently we've had a pediatric radiologist discussing the risk and efforts that are being made, at least locally, but as well as nationally through several radiologic organizations trying to decrease exactly what you're talking about. I think it's
right. The Pediatric Radiology Commission has a site called that is working on this, and they have a campaign to make radiation doses in children as low as reasonably achievable. And I think the pediatric radiologists should be saluted and thanked because they are leading the effort here. Donald Frush, a doctor at Duke University, has done an excellent job of warning about this problem, and we realize it's a problem of educating physicians and the rest of us because, again, a CAT scan can save lives, but used repeatedly, the amount of radiation really can be problematic.
You had mentioned earlier the issue of twins who have genetically identical DNA, and they're quite similar at birth, but with age there are significant changes which seem to be best explained by environmental impacts. Could you expand on what we're talking about there? I think this is an important area in lots of issues, not only in environmental risks for cancer, but also in some of the chronic diseases. So.
Well, the reason we have evidence on this is because in the Scandinavian countries, when you're born, you get a personal identification number, and your health outcomes and disease is tracked throughout your life. We're working now with colleagues at MD Anderson in Houston, Texas, to see the development of an electronic record, medical record, that will include occupational and environmental information along with information about your family history, medication history, and surgical history. When and if we have such a tool developed, we will be able to answer more and more questions about how the environment affects our lives and our health. But what they did in Scandinavia was to assemble several thousand pairs of twins. Now, I should say that twins aren't exactly identical at birth, even if they come from one egg, but they're as close to a clone as we have in human nature. And what these studies have shown is that when you follow those twins throughout their lifetime, they do not develop the same cancer even half the time. If it was all determined by our genes, you would expect them to develop the same cancer. They don't. What we find, in fact, is if you look at their chromosomes for something called methylation patterns, you find that their patterns are totally different by age 50. And what that's telling us is that the genes that they are born with, which are close to identical at birth, have been changed a great deal by interactions with the environment. And we know that some of the factors that can influence methylation patterns include, for example, a common plastic bisphenol A. Right now, next week, the FDA is holding hearings on whether or not it should issue a national warning about bisphenol A in baby bottles. Now, in Canada, and Walmart is moving to ban this. And they're doing this because the National Toxicology Program in the United States and international scientific review bodies have looked at the evidence and have concluded that bisphenol A, a very widely used plastic, in the plastic that has the number 7 on the bottom of it often, can get from that plastic into acid foods, into warm foods, and ultimately into the body of our children, and that it has the ability to have very powerful effects, particularly on baby boys. And we want to try to reduce that from happening, so we think it's important to minimize exposure. Now, the FDA looked at the recommendations that were made by the U.S. National Toxicology Program and didn't agree with it. And this, as you might imagine, has engendered a great deal of public interest, and I would urge all of your listeners concerned about this to get in touch with the FDA and let them know about their concerns, because this is one of these examples where science sometimes can't quite get us where we need to go alone, because, in fact, bisphenol A by itself doesn't look like it may be so harmful, but if we start out giving our babies bisphenol A, and then throughout their lives they're exposed, unfortunately, to hundreds to thousands of other materials, also at low levels, that may be affecting their development, their brain, and perhaps their risk of cancer, then by the time they reach adulthood, we've given them a toxic load that they would not otherwise have. And our children today are being born with levels of pollution in their bodies that did not exist when their grandparents were born.
I think I may have mentioned this in the last program. I know I've mentioned it on the program a couple of times, a rather striking and quick example of how environmental things not used in the house can cause human side effects is the association of lavender in some of the bath oils, bath soaps, and so forth is associated with the development of breast tissue in boys. It was recognized by a pediatric endocrinologist, and it's been kind of a circulating in the pediatric communities as a thing to think about when we see breast development in boys, which is not actually all that uncommon, and it was surprising. When it went to the lab, lavender acts very much like an estrogen.
Well, you know, that report is a preliminary report, and it's important to recognize that that you can have too much of a good thing. there are a number of natural products that can stimulate estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more concerned about some of the synthetic materials that we are widely using that aren't even labeled in, for example, some of the phthalates and other things that can be found in shampoos and bubble bath. For which there's widespread exposure and no information whatsoever. But one of the things we know is that there is an increase in premature breast development in girls. I don't know if there's an increase in breast growth in boys. Do you know?
I don't know that the incidence has increased. I can't answer that off the top of my head.
I don't think anybody can. I think it's an example of something we really haven't asked that question. But I do know this. There is an increase in breast growth in young girls. So much so that the Pediatric Endocrinology Society has seriously proposed thinking that breast growth is normal in a black girl at 7 and an 8 and in a white girl at 8. And some of us don't agree with that position. I've published on that with some colleagues as well, questioning that approach to making it normal, when in fact we ought to find out what is affecting so many of our young girls, causing them to go into premature puberty. And there is an excellent report by the gifted writer Sandra Steingraber that can be found on the Breast Cancer Fund website on why are our girls becoming mature earlier. Again, a newsletter we published has an excerpt from that on our website, preventingcancernow.org. But you're right that lavender was identified in this one set of case reports, and I think it's important for parents to be aware that you want to minimize exposing your children to things of that sort until we have better information on them.
This is Line 1, your Health Connection. I'm talking with Dr. Deborah Davis, and the questions that you might have relating to environmental effects and the causing cancer, this is a good time to call if you have any questions. Let me give you some contact numbers again. 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. The toll-free number, once again, 1-888-353-5752. Email line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. And I think I failed to mention you can also listen to this program again between 7 and 8 tonight, or go to kska.org. And at any time in the future, you could come back and look at this or listen to this webcast. And
I should add that if you go to deborahdavis.com, there's a list of both streaming video and audio files on a variety of different topics that people can find there.
Good, good. You know, one of the things that got my attention from reading your book and also talking to you last time, which I think is worth talking again about as well, is that I have grown up or have come to believe that cancer is a direct consequence of aging. And I think you tried to help us understand that that's maybe not true or probably not true. I'm not sure how to make that point.
Well, let's say this. There's an increase in childhood cancer, and that's not due to aging. There's an increase in testicular cancer, which affects young men, and that certainly can't be due to aging. But in a strange way, all cancer is involved in cells aging in that
right.
They lose their ability to fix themselves. And we know that repair gets worse with time. Having said that, there are situations and populations that live to old age and never develop cancer. And if we look internationally, we see that there are certain parts of the world where cancer is still relatively rare. It's 5 times more likely for a man in the United States to develop prostate cancer than it is for a man in Japan to develop prostate cancer. We don't know why. It's much more likely for women in the United States to develop breast cancer than it is for women in certain Asian countries to develop breast cancer. And again, we have some theories about what is involved. In both prostate and breast cancer, by the way, there have been recent findings that diets that are high in red meat and animal fat may put someone at risk of both breast and prostate cancer.
Are there other cancers that you're aware of that are seem to be increasing in prevalence or incidence in younger individuals than we might otherwise expect?
Well, we have a major research project examining that question in the U.S. and internationally. But let me also say that we have had some good news in cancer research, and I want to give my colleagues credit for that. We've had tremendous improvements in our ability to find and treat colorectal cancer. And anyone who has a family history of the disease should have their colonoscopy in their 40s, and anyone else should have one in their 50s. And if you're clean, you don't need another one for 10 years. But if you find a polyp, it's really important to understand that that can be removed before it becomes a cancer. And that approach is saving lives today. So although it's an unpleasant procedure, it's important for people to go through it. It's also true that we are reducing deaths from breast cancer now, and we don't fully understand all the reasons why. It may have something to do with the fact that we're not using as much hormone replacement therapy. It could also be related to the fact that we have less DDT and other persistent pesticides in the environment now than we had in the past. But having said that, your question is, are we seeing an increase in cancers today in young people? And the answer, unfortunately, is while childhood cancer is rare, it is less rare today than it used to be. We don't understand all the reasons for this, but certainly we know that studies have been done on fathers and have found that men who work with certain pesticides or solvents or as painters have an increased chance of having children with brain cancer. That's telling us that something that happens to men before they become fathers or perhaps early exposures that take place when their children are very young is transmitted to their children and affects their risk of developing brain cancer. A similar thing has been found with respect to woodworking and childhood leukemia. So we understand that father's occupation has an effect on their children's risk of developing cancer. And we also are doing work at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute where we are looking at cancers not related to smoking. Now, I want to say, any one of your listeners knows you should not be smoking. If you are smoking, you're hooked and you need to get medical help. The treatments for helping people stopping smoking now are very effective. You just have to, you know, get your foot in the door. And they range from using acupuncture and drugs to a whole host of techniques that people can rely on to stop smoking. But we are looking at the question of, is there an increase in cancer that has nothing to do with smoking and screening? And what we found is that there is a general increase in men and women in cancer today unrelated to smoking or diagnostic improvements.
We know that exercise seems to be increasingly being looked at as a benefit, and I think there's maybe a relationship between that, the more that somebody's exercising that and not having cancer. Is that suggesting that perhaps some of the cancer that we are seeing is related to our more sedentary habits and our dietary habits as well?
That's an excellent point. We do have a growing evidence on certain types of cancer, breast, colorectal in particular, that regular exercise, it can be protective. Even if you have had cancer, regular exercise appears to be really important for keeping you well. But there's a new set of work that's been done by Professor Randall Jertl from Duke University that has found that certain plastics like bisphenol A can actually stimulate obesity. And that things that can stimulate obesity in animals and us may also be involved in stimulating cancer. The same processes that can cause animals to become very fat in their young life may also cause them to develop cancer later on because there's inflammation that goes on at the cell level. inflammation that causes cells to plump up and develop adipocytes and become kind of fat-loving cells, those same processes may be involved in cancer formation. So there's a real interesting confluence of developing now where people are understanding that the things that stimulate obesity may also be stimulating the development of cancer. And one other interesting thing that I discuss in my book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, is that aspartame may be an appetite stimulant, and there's new evidence that it increases the risk of cancer in older people who've taken it their entire life, based on animal studies recently produced in Italy by some of the world's leading researchers at the Ramazzini Foundation. They found when you expose animals prenatally to aspartame that a third of them would develop tumors when they reached the equivalent of their 60s, 70s, or 80s. And one of the things you have to ask yourself is this. Throughout the United States, and Alaska too, we have more obesity than ever before. We have the highest rate of consumption of aspartame and artificial sweeteners. Maybe there's a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And two other questions that have come in by listeners who just wanted to leave the question. And we've talked a lot about estrogens, and that raised the question about soy products, which the listener says may act as a natural estrogen. What do we know about soy products and their acting as an estrogen, and particularly as they might be related to cancer?
Soy can be estrogenic. It is therefore not recommended that someone who has had breast cancer use a diet that's high in soy. But in many situations, we tend to go overboard. We think if a little soy may be good for you, then a lot might be better. And it turns out that you can have too much of a good thing in this regard. So I think that moderation in all things is advised. And I think that it is true that soy is estrogenic when tested in the laboratory. And we want to advise moderation. Have soy as part of a broad diet unless you have had breast cancer.
And another question is the one that's been around for a while, and that's the relationship between cancer and electromagnetic transformers is what the question is, and high-voltage wires.
Well, the National Toxicology Program issued a report on this some years ago, which concluded that those small number of people who live near high-voltage switching stations, which is fewer than 1% of the U.S. population, are at an increased risk of childhood leukemia as a result of this exposure, and that men who work near high-voltage switching stations also have an increased risk of breast cancer. And my book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, I discuss this and provide some of the more than 20 different studies that have been done finding this, but the exposures have been unusual. High-voltage switching stations and high-exposure electricity in the workplace are unusual exposures. They have been confirmed by scientists working at the International Agency for Research on Cancer as well, but there is a very active debate on these data, and unfortunately the debate is leaving a lot of people very confused because it's been carried out not solely with objective scientific information, but in a highly politicized environment where public relations campaigns play more of a role than the science. That is why Dr. Herbermann, who directs the Cancer Institute, and I are calling for a new approach to information on toxic hazards. We think the cell phone industry and the electricity industry and producers need to provide funding with no strings attached for independent researchers in the university to evaluate these questions. And only when that is made available will it be possible for people to have any confidence in the findings. Because right now, researchers have found something very interesting. Of all of the studies that have not found any risk associated with cell phones, most of them have been funded by the cell phone industry. Now, maybe it's just a coincidence, but in order for us to know, it would really be important to have true independent funding of research. And until we have that, I think it's not going to be possible for the public to have confidence that we are being protected adequately.
We have about 8 minutes left, and I think this is a good opportunity to get into the issue of the economics and of all of this. I think there's a your book makes it clear that there's often an industrial counter attack on the science that's coming out, and it seems that we somehow need to be having a more open dialogue, which is, I notice on your website that you would promote. It makes me think about how Jeffrey Sachs of the Earth Institute is talking about good environmentally policies and being economically sound on environmental issues. Does that make sense to you? And if so, what's being done in that regard?
That is absolutely what we want to promote, is more of the development of truly independent information, so that we can get base. I'm sorry. I hope that noise isn't coming through on your end.
Yeah, we're getting some breakup or some...
Right. Hold on just a moment, please.
Yeah. Could be a cell phone.
That it's actually probably a cordless phone, which is a good time for me to say that cordless phones actually do emit radio frequency as well. And that's one of the problems with many of the negative studies on cordless phones, by the way, is they haven't asked, the negative studies on cell phones have not asked any information about cordless phones. Hmm. And so many of us are using cordless phones and have no idea that they emit radio frequency exposure. So that's a challenge to the work that needs to be done. But as to the economics, yes, we have been in a situation, an adversarial situation, for far too long, and I think we've reached some maturity as a society where we know that has to end. I call in my book for a commission on toxic hazard, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And what that is based on is a recognition that the current system, adversarial system of lawsuits, is not working to protect public health. In fact, the courts have increasingly reduced the possibility that plaintiffs who are seeking recovery for toxic damage will be rewarded anything at all, and the whole system isn't working at all. And we have to recognize that, and also recognize that punitive damages, well, every once in a while they are awarded, often, as you saw recently even with the Exxon Valdez, those punitive damages are being reversed and working against the whole system. So I haven't worked out the details of this, and I would welcome anyone listening who cares to get involved. But I think we need to call for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission on Toxic Hazard, where companies come forward with information that they have about the health of their workers and the communities who work with materials they manufacture. And in exchange for making that information known to scientists and available for scientific analysis, they provide medical costs for people but are immune from punitive damages. If that were to be done on a large scale, then we would break this logjam now, where whether it's Vioxx or other things, the companies basically refuse to cooperate and understand that they will, given the way the court systems are working now, come out often ahead. But public health suffers as a result. So I'm calling for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, a no-fault, if you will, commission on toxic hazard, recognizing that many of the major chemical companies self-insure, and that means that they have the medical records of their workers, and they know whether they have, for example, an excess rate of brain cancer or breast cancer. And if they were to make that information available to researchers for independent evaluation, it would allow us to come up with more intelligent policies to protect the rest of us, our children, and our grandchildren.
In the last couple of minutes, perhaps I could ask you to discuss some of the more common things you think we should all be trying to do to decrease our risk. You have that information on your website, but I thought it might be nice to go ahead and just talk about a couple of the more important issues in your mind.
Well, I would ask you, because I don't have the material in front of me, we start with, of course, some of the simple things about smoking and asbestos. If you think you have asbestos in your home, you must get it inspected by someone who knows what to do, and don't disturb it yourself. Often the best thing to do with asbestos is nothing. Leave it alone. But if it does need to be removed, or you need to go in and fix a lighting problem or electrical wiring problem, you need someone who knows what they're doing, because Unfortunately, today, we're seeing growing numbers of mesothelioma, a tumor of the lining of the lung that is thought to be uniquely associated with asbestos, and we're seeing more and more cases in people who have never worked with asbestos, and so they must be getting exposed in their homes or schools or in some other way. Another thing it's important to do is to have your homes inspected for radon, because radon is an invisible radioactive decay gas because it comes from deep within the earth and can be released very easily, fixed through simple things that can be done in your home to reduce your exposure to that.
Okay. Well, I really want to say thanks again for all you're doing, plus spending the time with us. It's been a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you twice and to look at your book and explore your website. So thanks very much for all you're doing.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Woodard, because I appreciate your interest, and I'm eager to learn more about Alaska. You know, a place that thinks of the rest of the world as outside has a kind of insular attitude in a sense, but I think the lessons of the polar bear are very, very important. Those polar bears are showing up with residues of toxic pollution, and they don't work in factories, and they didn't work on any military base, but they are those pollutants are moving up the food chain, and I think they're giving us a very powerful message that while the rest of the world may be outside, there are no barriers, and we live in one world and one planet, and we've got to work together to figure out how to make it a safer and healthier place.
Thanks again. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Our guest today has been Dr. Deborah Davis of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Environmental Oncology. You can listen to more of her at the Wendy Williamson Thursday night at 7 p.m., where she'll be giving a talk on the causes and prevention of cancer, how what we do today has an effect on the health of future generations. In addition, she's going to be at the Providence Cancer Center in their media center Friday on September 12th from 12 to 1 p.m. Next week, however, we're going to be moving on to a new guest, Dr. Franklin Ellenson. Dr. Ellenson is a neurologist here in Anchorage, and we've not addressed Parkinson's disease. So if you would like, save up your questions, concerns, worries, and questions about treatment and what's new in the whole issue of Parkinson's disease, and feel free to give us a call next week. So tune into your health and learn more on Monday, September 15th at 2 p.m. Remember, we repeat each evening after our Monday program at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.